Thank you. Dr. Southcott?
All right, so we just...
We have to go back.
Yeah, can we go back to
We have to go
meeting?
Back to Dr. Heffel, right?
Yeah. So thank you guys again for the invitation to provide comments. I'm a urologist. I'm the chief of the urology at North Shore University. I'm a local Chicago guy. I did all my training and fellowship at Northwestern, and now I'm part of the University of Chicago up in North Shore, so extending from Edmonton all the way to Wisconsin. I am a consultant for PROCEPT, the maker of Aquablation. Having said that, I'm not here on their behalf today, but rather to kind of share my experience. I have a high interest, both from a clinical standpoint in getting patients the right care, but also a large research interest also in why men not only get benign prosthetic hyperplasia or BPH, but also in kind of identifying obstruction into why they don't receive treatment. I have several NIH grants in this field. Nonetheless, Aquablation has really met a lot of these needs. And just to give you guys some background here, most men, as we age, our prostates grow, and this enlargement obstructs the bladder and makes it work harder to empty, and that is associated with a lot of lower urinary tract symptoms. It's going to the bathroom frequently, waking up in the middle of the night, et cetera. And this poses a large problem for a vast majority of men. In fact, if you query community-dwelling men, over 85% of them will report some degree of urinary symptoms and or bother associated with the BPH or benign prosthetic enlargement. And because of this, you would think that every man at some point should get treatment. Nonetheless, is the vast majority of men do not receive treatment in the United States, and this is relatively related to many things, but because they do not like medications. In fact, if you look at the overall compliance and use of medications for BPH, the vast majority, over 60 to 70%, will try it, and within 12 months, they will actually stop their therapy. And then they don't seek treatment. And this is a very bothersome component that is they're exhibiting avoidance behaviors, meaning they will go places, find bathrooms, say, I will avoid going X number of miles without stopping. On the golf course, they will actually just use the bathroom there. So this is very bothersome. So, again, why are then more men not getting surgery? When you start querying men into why they avoid surgery, they, number one, are afraid of undergoing an operation. Two, they are afraid of long indwelling catheters. And more importantly is a lot of men don't like the perceived notion of sexual side effects. And when we talk about BPH and a lot of the conventional therapies, we're talking about retrograde ejaculation or decreased amount of ejaculate and orgasm and a fear that this is going to change their overall sexual quality. So this is where my interest a while back started in Aquablation and its use for the treatment of BPH because it provided the opportunity for decreased side effects. And there's many reasons, including the fact that the system doesn't use energy. It spares the anatomy toward part of the prostate, which is really responsible for the sexual function. And it's overall, when you look at the overall rate, it's about 5% in men undergoing Aquablation compared to the conventional therapies, which is 80 to 90%. And when we talk about maintaining quality of life, this is important to most guys, which has not been offered by our gold standard or any of the vast majority of therapies that are resective and provide potentially long-term relief for patients. I show this as really my initial experience with Aquablation. I have done many patients since then, but I use these patients in particular because these four were really coming to me not only with moderate to severe urinary tract symptoms, but they have been all maxed out on medical therapies. They really didn't like any of the therapies, never wanted to be on the traditional because of the sexual side effects. And they really were kind of wanting treatment, but were deathly afraid of the other therapies. In fact, were putting off these therapies until they found a therapy that would have met all of their needs. And as you can see here, what we measure a patient's success in these type of treatments is by using the IPSS score, And that's just a measurement of how severe the urinary symptoms are. And if you look at the yellow boxes there, all of these men had severe urinary symptoms before. And then after the procedure, very quickly, they had significant improvement within their urinary symptoms. But if you looked at all of these, with the exception of one who ultimately became non-sexually active afterwards, not because of the therapy, but because of his own experience, they all maintained the ability to have their anterograde or normal sexual functions following. All were in the hospital for 24 hours, and they all had significant improvements in their quality of life. All were taken off of their medical therapies, and all did well. And when we look specifically at the proxy for how much resection did we do, you can use PSA, which is the commonly used screening test, blood test for prostate cancer. We can also use that as a proxy for PSA volume. And if you look, there was a significant reduction in the PSA in all of these patients, which is equivalent to my series of TERP patients as well. So this is providing and probably the level of evidence I need to reinforce that we are doing the adequate resection of tissue. And no adverse events were seen in these patients, but any of the patients that I've since treated. And all of these, I should say, are real-world experience that are comparable to the level 1 data that was provided by the WATER 1 and 2 studies. Next slide. So one of the really cool things that I like is that we can do this on men with really large prostates. And just so to understand is when you do a TERP on a patient with a large prostate, just plan on being there for hours. And a lot of times you have to do that in two separate procedures. And then there's risk of complications, blood transfusions, and other type of electrolyte abnormalities that can occur. So in more modern era, I do a lot of robotic surgery. I've historically done a lot of robotic prostatectomies to kind of remove the adenoma, the inner juicy part of the prostate, as a treatment for these BPH patients. That is a very costly procedure. The hospital stay is anywhere between 3 to 5 days. The bleeding is less compared to open procedures. And overall, patients do well, but there is some complication risk that occur because even though it's more minimally invasive, we are still opening the bladder, and there's a lot of other potential leakage problems and infections that have since occurred. But if you look at that compared to the WATER II study and even compared to my own personal experience, aquablation kind of bypasses all of this. There's a limited amount of time we need with a catheter. All of my large patient prostates were decatheterized within 24 hours. None of them in my study needed any type of transfusions. We used minimal cautery at best, and simple traction occurred, and all, again, were discharged from the hospital within 24 hours. When you look at overall patient satisfaction of my large prostate guys after aquablation, they are equivalent, if not better, than the robotic simple experience that I've had. And so it's with that that I really have been endorsing and using aquablation. And when I describe the overall choices that to patients of you can do a TERP, we can do a simple, we can do a laser, depending on what your wishes are, I have yet to have a patient say, I don't want aquablation. And it's really motivated because of the decreased sexual side effects and the overall improvement. And yes, while there's only limited 2-year data based on when the technology became available, just based on the overall resection abilities of the aquablation, there's no reason to think that these are going to have longer kind of recurrences. I have yet, in fact, to see a bladder neck contracture following this procedure, which historically, even after a TURP and certainly a laser procedure, was a big complication. So I am excited, and certainly my patients have been excited to use aquablation, and certainly, especially in the Medicare community, do think that this will be the kind of standard for here as we move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions, Dr. Haug?
Yeah, I just have a couple. I take it, Dr. Helfand, you were involved with the WATER II study?
I was not, actually. I was following along, and I'm always one of the most cautious, and certainly that's what my colleagues would probably critique me as before I get involved in any type of technologies. If I'm going to offer it to a patient as a non-study therapy, that I want to make sure that the data is actually supported, and certainly that was my motivation, so I actually held off.
Okay, because I couldn't tell unless it you had part of the water too, how many of the large prostates you've done. You alluded to that you've done some, but the first slide you had just showed 80 gram or under prostate, so it didn't show any of the large ones. How many large ones have you done?
Now about 10 to 12. So it's you can still say it's a low number, but the large ones don't come around every day. So
do you think ultimately the place for aquablation will be mostly in the area of large prostates or equal for large and small?
So it's interesting is that, you know, I think it certainly will have large size, but really based on the overall profile, I think a lot of my men with smaller prostates because of the decreased side effects are really kind of itching to get it. And again, is that because we're really conforming the aquablation therapy to that size of the prostate, whether it's small or large, it really doesn't make a difference from a technical standpoint. And so that's really what I think is one of the most exciting parts about it.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that. My background is surgery, and you mentioned from a technical standpoint. And as I read this, internists always think of surgeons as just technicians. But it seems to me when I read this and see how automated it becomes once it's programmed in, that the quote-unquote surgeon really is in the role of a technician. Do you have any, this doesn't say anything about the value of the procedure, just as one surgeon to another. That's what I found myself thinking about. Any thoughts on that?
Well, there's still, so as a urologist, you still need basic skills. And certainly, you know, there have been observers certainly from, you know, general surgery and other who have just been heard about this technology and kind of peeked their head in. And you still really need to understand the ultrasound, how that, you know, and we're pretty well versed in that just from doing biopsies and other prostate procedures. You still have to be somewhat savvy, if you will, in setting up, you know, a cystoscope and aligning it appropriately and kind of defining the anatomy in there. And yes, the actual, you know, technical part about it, once it's all kind of primed and aligned, is that you can just, you know, press a button. But the technical skills going in are a little bit more. And I only want to add to that is that we have a preliminary study that really we, you know, have taken now about 20 of our trainees and asked them to say, hey, I want you to take this ultrasound image if you're going to do aquablation and plan out your resection plan. And the cool part about it is that as a urologist, we all are pretty much can pick out the right plan to do when we kind of draw it ourselves, which really means that universally that we should have kind of uniform results when using this, which I can tell you for the other therapies is not there.
Thank you.
Anyone else on the line or anyone here? Okay.
As a reminder to ask a question or make a comment, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. That's star 1.
Operator, while they're thinking about doing that, would we see if Dr. Kaplan is connected?
What's the first name?
Steve.
I think he's in the operating room right now, so I'm not sure, Dr. Kaplan. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's going to be able to get on. He texted me, so I don't think.
Okay.
Sorry.
Never mind, operator. We think we just found where he is, and it's not near a phone.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Let's put through some slides here.
Excuse me, I'm the speaker. We were informed, perhaps incorrectly, that we would only have 15 minutes total for presentation. Obviously, that is not the case. I really prepared a very abbreviated presentation because of time limitations, and we would like to postpone, if we could, our response to the LCD because we think we understand now that we can present better information. This would not be the most comprehensive presentation because I only had was told I had 15 minutes. Additionally, we were told that this meeting would run from 12 to 1:30, and maybe that was incorrect as well. Some of us have planes to catch, but, I mean, I'll present if you want, but we really are requesting that we present this at your next meeting. Is that possible?
I think the issue with that would be that there probably won't be may not be another meeting until February, number one. Number two, we didn't anticipate so many presenters responding as they did, and I think we need to let Dr. Belli present, and then we'll listen to your presentation.
So what basically would have to happen is this is an open meeting for this LCD. So there is a process that's in line, right, that the comment period ends November 9th, and then it goes through the process of being formalized. So your best bet would be to present what you have and then submit in writing everything else that you wanted to submit. Because what I'm trying to say is you can speak at the meetings are scheduled for draft LCDs that are being brought to the meeting, and this LCD will not be brought to the next meeting. So commenting in February will not necessarily, you know, affect any of this. As far as the number of the amount of time and the scheduling, in response to the responses, the last week of this time that we had open is when we got most of the responses of people saying we would like to present and come. And so, again, because of the nature of what this meeting is about, we had to accommodate them. And so we all scrambled, including me changing my flight just yesterday, to accommodate and allow everybody to be listened to, because that is what this meeting is for. But we couldn't really, we couldn't control that because we didn't get the request to present until, you know, the week of that it was going to end. And we got several after it had been closed that we had to respond and say, we're sorry, we can't accommodate you as a presenter. So I do want to apologize as much as we can for the people that had the flight kind of issues. But
is it possible just to take this off the table until February?
We need to have a presentation at an open meeting.
Yes.
Yes, but could you hold off?
That would mean the whole policy is not going through at all and has to start its whole, you know, the whole process all over again. You know, we would have to probably take this offline for later on and see what's going on, but it's scheduled to be presented at this meeting, so we will go ahead and do that.
So two points. One is that we were told, based on your regulations, it said we have 10 minutes per presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So we prepared 10 minutes.
Per presentation.
Right, and we were told that was for the whole company. Based on how we interpreted it, we were told 10 minutes for the whole company, so we are not fairly represented, point number one. The second is there is a nor'easter happening, and if we don't get our flights, we will not be able to leave here.
And so
we need to do is have Dr. Alladelli do an introduction to the policy, and then if you can present what you have, and if there's things that you need to present beyond that, we can look at it in writing, or we can arrange perhaps
a representation of what we could have been presenting. We could have had 5 or 6 speakers here.
I don't want to spend any more time on talking about the presentation when we're wasting time as far as getting down what you have.
I understand, but I think we're not going to be fairly judged.
Let us hear what you have after Becca Odelli speaks, and then we'll see.
Okay, the next draft LCD is multi-marker serum test related to ovarian cancer testing. And as it says on the slide, serum-based tests have been proposed to triage patients with malignant versus benign adnexal masses. Suggested use of the test is to identify women who have a higher likelihood of malignant disease and may benefit from referral to a gynecologic oncology specialist. These tests are combinations of several separate lab tests known as MAAAs and are performed on a blood sample by a reference lab using a proprietary algorithm. Could you go to the next slide, please? So this, basically, the summary of it is that this particular draft LCD is a non-coverage policy for multi-marker serum tests related to ovarian cancer testing for postmenopausal women. Next slide, please. So in the summary of evidence, we did a literature search in PubMed using the Hayes search criteria for each of the tests that we had looked at, which would be OVA1, OVERA, which is the next generation of OVA1, and the ROMA. In total, we found 15 non-duplicated studies that were for OVA1, and only 6 studies met inclusion criteria. 5 of the 6 studies had limitations in that they included patients who had been evaluated by gynecs prior to being tested, which kind of negates the whole point. Most of the studies contained overlapping patient populations, and all the studies were funded by the test manufacturer. There were 5 studies in all that we found that evaluated clinical validity. Could you go to the next slide, please? Medicare population is most likely to be postmenopausal women, and according to evaluation and management of Adnexal Mass's ACOG practice bulletin number 174, which is November 2016, which replaced the one from 2007, the combination of an elevated CA125 and a pelvic mass ultrasound and a pelvic mass in a postmenopausal woman is highly suspicious of malignancy, and patients with these findings should be referred to or treated in consultation with a gynec. In light of this, ordering and performing any of the lab tests that we reviewed in this document would be considered not medically reasonable or necessary for postmenopausal women, and therefore is non-covered. And after reviewing, we did have an open CAC meeting, which is a carrier advisory committee meeting in April of this year. And after that, we revised this to include a statement that claims for multi-marker serum tests related to ovarian cancer testing for premenopausal women may be considered for payment upon appeal. So I think that is the last slide.
Thank you for allowing me to comment on the NGS proposed LCD concerning multi-marker serum tests related to ovarian cancer detection. My name is Charles Dunton. I'm a gynecologic oncologist who's practiced for 30 years.
Can you hear the physician on the phone?
I can hear it.
I can, yes.
Okay, I was just concerned they could.
My financial disclosures are that I am employed by Vermilion, and I'm giving this presentation on behalf of the company. Next. So what we are asking is that NGS recommend the coverage for OVA1, a multivariate index assay, as part of the evaluation of women with an indeterminate pelvic mass. This is after imaging is performed on a pelvic mass, and it's not clearly benign or malignant. And in my experience, most ultrasounds, which are the imaging studies that we use, fall into this risk. They're not benign, or they're clearly malignant or clearly benign, but the majority are in this indeterminate group. Just to give you the current state of affairs of ovarian cancer, there's over 22,000 cases of ovarian cancer, and it's the most deadly gynecologic malignancy. Most cases are found in late-stage disease with a higher mortality, and unfortunately, because of that, the overall mortality from this disease is greater than 50%. Most ovarian cancers are diagnosed in women over the age of 65. And while the majority of the pelvic masses in premenopausal women are seen in premenopausal women, the majority of the ovarian cancers are in postmenopausal women with masses. Now, there are approximately 1,000 gynecologic oncologists in the United States, the difficulty is gynecologic oncologists are going to show you data that shows that they have the best outcomes when they treat women with ovarian cancer, but it is not possible for every patient with a pelvic mass to see a gynecologic oncologist. It's just not possible. So the summary of the evidence we're going to support this, talk about FDA clearance, review published studies, talk about national guidelines from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, give new data that we've just published on racial disparity in the detection of ovarian cancer, and talk about coverage from other entities. Next. So FDA clearance and the Medicare coverage, if you look at OVA1 has been cleared by the FDA for use in assessing risk of malignancy in a pelvic mass prior to performing surgery. And it is covered by Medicare via Novitas LCD. CA125, however, is not cleared for assessing risk of malignancy. It's only cleared for following women with a diagnosis of ovarian cancer to see response to therapy or possible recurrence. It is not covered by Medicare on a national coverage determination, specifically because it lacks the sensitivity and specificity of the test, is not sufficient. And I have had patients where prior to my use of OVA1, I would order a CA125 preoperatively, and the patient would call that Medicare would not cover that test, which I thought was necessary. It will cover OVA1. Peer-reviewed evidence, which we will cite many other papers in our written replies, but OVA1 has been shown to have the highest sensitivity and negative predictive value when assessing the risk of an ovarian cancer with these undiagnosed and indeterminate pelvic masses. And this is very important for proper triage of a patient prior to her first surgery. So if you have a negative predictive value that's very high, that patient can be taken care of locally by her gynecologist and does not have to go to a gynecologic oncologist. And these papers that were cited here, it's important that this has the highest sensitivity for early stage ovarian cancer, where we can do the most in taking care of that patient, properly staging them, and giving them better outcomes if they are taken care of by gynecologic oncologists. It's higher sensitivity in premenopausal women, also postmenopausal women as well, and sensitivity in non-Caucasian women is something that is new that we'll show you the data on. Next slide, please. So ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, 2016, notes that OVA1 in conjunction with imaging shows a negative predictive value as high as 99% when both studies are low risk. And this allows for the general gynecologist to care for those patients and not refer them to a specialist. OVA1 is not a diagnostic assay, but has to be combined with both clinical impression and imaging. OVA1 is far superior to CA125, and I'll show you the data, in detection of what we call less common ovarian histopathologies. So most ovarian cancers are high-grade serous carcinomas, but about 20 to 30% are other mucinous tumors, endometrioid tumors, and they are not specifically CA125 really targets only epithelial antigens, and OVA1 covers all of those histologies. I use this table because of limitations of time, but I could show you many others, and what you see here is that the superior performance of OVA1 versus CA125. Over 1,000 patients have been studied prospectively to get FDA clearance, and this is one of the trials. And if you look here at the non-ovarian histologies, the sensitivity for OVA1 is about 80%. If you look at CA125, no matter which cutoff you use, it is much lower. And importantly, in early stage disease, overall, you see that it is that stage 1 disease is in the 80%, and stage 2 is 100% for OVA1, and in with CA125, it's in the 60 to 70% range. And if you look at premenopausal women in early stage, OVA1 is much higher sensitivity, and importantly, in postmenopausal women, in early stage disease, you see it over 80% with OVA1 and 75% with CA125, no matter which cutoff you use. And that's where we can do the most good in taking care of those patients and have the best outcomes for those patients by identifying them and getting them to the proper doctor. Next. And what is the influence of gynecologic oncologists? This is data that has been around for quite a while, and why NCCN says that that if you have a suspicion of ovarian cancer, it should go to a gynecologic oncologist. If we're involved in the surgery and treatment, we properly stage the patient, we increase the chances of survivability, and reduce repeat procedures. So if a gynecologist takes care of a patient and finds that they have an ovarian cancer and they're not prepared to do the proper staging, including taking lymph node dissections, performing an omentectomy, doing biopsies, or even doing a debulking procedure, that patient probably have to go back for a second procedure. here's data from showing that at least 10% increased survivability in patients taken care of by a gynecologic oncologist, and some studies actually show an increase in survivability of up to 25%. And if you get the right, OVA1 allows us to get the right patients to the right doctor to improve overall outcomes. Next. So at the open TAC meeting, I think you call it, one of the physicians said that, well, it's not a problem because all patients with a pelvic mass can go to a gynecologic oncologist. This physician is from Connecticut. And if you look at the distribution of gynecologic oncologists throughout, this is from 2016, but I assure you that the numbers are not much higher, approximately 1,000 gynecologic oncologists. And in Connecticut, that may be true. But in most parts of the country and in your coverage areas, it is not true. Women have to travel, and there's a limited number of gynecologic oncologists. Currently, I fill in for a physician in southern Indiana. 2 hours from, he is the only gynecologic oncologist within 2 hours of any other gynecologic oncologist. He is so busy, his waiting list is 3 weeks to see a patient, and it might be another 3 weeks before he operates on the patient. So, by using OVA1 with a high negative predictive value, those patients that don't have cancer can be cared for and alleviate the burden on gynecologic oncologists. But it is really not possible for a gynecologic oncologist to see every woman with a pelvic mass and perform the surgery. Next. ACOG recommendations for OVA1. So consultation to or referral to a gynecologic oncologist is recommended for an adnexal woman with adnexal masses, pre or postmenopausal, with an elevated score on a formal risk assessment test such as the multivariate analysis index assay OVA1. Next. And this is clinical care pathway that we think should be followed. So if an ultrasound is performed, which is a level A ACOG recommendation, it's the only level A, and it's clearly benign, that we watch and wait those patients. If it's clearly malignant, so we see ascites or masses outside of the ovary, those patients should be referred directly to a GYN oncologist and just get a CA-125. The majority of these are not clear. You're going to see complex masses. They may have some septations, some nodularity, but it's not clear that they're cancer. And we think that this ACOG B-level recommendation for OVA1 here will allow the patient to get to the right doctor and go to the GYN oncologist if necessary, or if they're low-risk patients, be cared for by their general gynecologist. Next slide, please. So this is new data that we published just this year, and we looked at this because there were four independent publications outside of the company that looked at CA-125 levels in Caucasian and non-Caucasian, mostly African-American women, and they looked at levels of CA-125. And in each of those studies, where there were healthy women, women with family histories or genetic testing, putting them at risk for ovarian cancer, or women with ovarian cancer, African-American women had lower CA-125 levels than Caucasian women. And we shouldn't be surprised about this, but we know the PSA levels are different between different ethnicities. So we went back and looked at the prospective collected data within our studies and looked at the patients who were African-American versus Caucasian. And if you look at this data here, you see that OVA1, the MIA, is better in Caucasian women, no matter what cutoff you use, with sensitivities above 90%. But in African-American women, while OVA1 is lower because CA-125 is part of the five proteins that we measure, it is significantly better than CA-125 in this group of women. So we feel that this is a significant finding. And when I present this to other GYN oncologists, they say, we didn't know that. So we've just published this in the last several months. Next slide, please. So payer coverage, government, Medicare covers this via the Novitas LCD and Medicare Advantage plans. Multiple Blue Cross Blue Shield plans cover its testing across the country. Other commercial payers such as Cigna covers this, and it is in EviCore guidelines that OVA1 is a test that should be covered. Next. So in summary, and I could have presented a lot more data, we could have had more speakers here. The proposed LCD does not reflect published evidence, in my opinion, clinical practice. I know you've excluded publications for OVA1, but we don't know which ones you've excluded because that Hayes data is not available publicly. We'd like to know why. We think it's inconsistent with ACOG guidelines for recommendations, which are national guidelines follows, and it restricts coverage for postmenopausal women to CA125. Certainly, if the CA125 is elevated in a postmenopausal woman with a mass, she should be referred. The issue is, what if it is not elevated and you have a false negative CA125? And we've shown you that sensitivity is better for over one, so you may have a patients that you're saying, we want you to just use CA125, and they may have a cancer, and they're not going to get to the right doctor. And additionally, Medicare and their national coverage determination specifically excludes coverage of CA125, and therefore that's not going to be covered by patients who need testing. And importantly, of the five components, we break out CA125 in the result. So the patient's not disadvantaged by not knowing what the clinician is not disadvantaged by not knowing what the CA125 is, because that's given, a test score is given for over one, and the CA125 is given out separately. So I would like to ask Dr. Randell to come up and speak as a gynecologist who sees women with adnexal masses and has to make determinations of the best things to do for his patients.
Thank you, Dr. Devon. Good afternoon. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to really present my clinical experience as a practicing gynecological surgeon in Atlanta. I see a lot of women with adnexal masses, and it really is a diagnostic dilemma for the practicing OBGYN to know whether or not that adnexal mass is cancer or it's benign. I remember taking my boards down the street at the Westin Hotel back in 1997, and on my series of cases, I did a lot of laparoscopic surgery for adnexal masses. And back in 1997, that was like, oh my God, what is he doing? What if it was cancer? Well, now we have a better ability to know prior to getting to the operating room whether or not that adnexal mass is cancer. Because I'm not a gynecological oncologist. I'm a benign gynecologist doing a lot of surgery. And the worst thing that can happen for me is to get into a situation where I'm operating on a woman with an adnexal mass and I don't know that it's cancer. Because what I could do is actually upstage her disease. And we know that if we can catch cancer at an early stage, there's a better prognosis. So in terms of what the ACOG guidelines that were mentioned at the introduction, is that ACOG talks about women with an elevated CA125 should be referred for surgery by a GYN oncologist. Well, the problem is, as you heard Dr. Dutton refer to, is that 50% of early stage ovarian cancers have normal CA125. I've had in my patients several patients that have had ovarian masses. They've had a normal CA125. Over one was elevated. They were found to have cancer. So had I taken that patient just relying on the CA125 to surgery, believing that it was benign based on what ACOG is saying, I would have missed those patients. I would have potentially done a surgery that would have upstaged her disease, and that would be a worse prognosis for the patient. So I believe, especially with the postmenopausal patients, when you saw that, I don't know if we can go back to the slide there, that show the difference in sensitivity, we know that sensitivity is significantly increased in the postmenopausal patient with early stage disease. That's the challenge. Advanced stage disease is pretty obvious to anyone. It's the early stage disease that's difficult to detect. And as you can see on that slide here, comparing CA125 with OVA1.
Now, if you go back a little bit.
Yeah, one back. Let's see, the disparity. Yeah. Right here. So you can see here with the early stage, it's at 91.7% sensitivity at OVA1. Versus 75% for CA125. So in clinical practice, you know, there's 1,000 GYN oncologists, there's about 40,000 OBGYNs. So the majority of these women with adnexal masses are being seen by the general gynecologist. And we have to direct them to the oncologist, but the oncologists, there's a lot of work for them. They don't have time to be managing benign disease. So with a high negative predictive value of over 1, we can keep these patients. We talk about the improved sensitivity, but a negative predictive value is key as well. That is, if a patient has an adnexal mass and she has a low risk score on over 1, she's unlikely to have ovarian cancer. That patient could be kept by the general gynecologist and operated on and not worry about cancer. So with over 1, we see an improvement in sensitivity. That's the ability of the test to detect the disease, that being ovarian cancer, as well as the improved negative predictive value. I like to call that peace of mind. Peace of mind to me as the practitioner and peace of mind to my patient, saying that you have a mass, but with the over 1 score showing low probability malignancy, it's unlikely this is cancer. And that is very powerful to a patient to know prior to going to the operating room that it's unlikely that she has ovarian cancer. Thank you.
Yeah, I actually had a question.
Okay. To me or Dr. Dunn?
To you.
Okay.
You know, you mentioned something now, and Dr. Chereau had also mentioned this during the CAC, which was both of you gave examples now that technically with what you had described earlier, this person would not be getting over 1 in the first place because the ultrasound was, you know, you were pretty sure about the ultrasound.
It was not. It would be indeterminate. So it was an indeterminate. If it's obvious cancer, there's really no need to do any additional testing. So if I see ascites, if I see bilaterality, if I see large masses with excrescences, it's high probability of cancer. That patient would probably be referred. There would be no reason for me to.
You just said that you would have gone ahead and done that, or not you, but the patient would have gone ahead and had surgery, and it would have been exposed, right? It would have worsened her situation or elevated her situation. But by doing over 1, she ended up getting to have the surgery by a radiation. By a gynecologic oncologist. So unless I'm mishearing what you said, So therefore, something was avoided. And I'm just bringing that up because that's the second kind of time that when it's time to give an example, the examples we're getting are people who, had I not done this, you know, like the patient's presentation or picture looked like it was okay, right?
So let me clarify. The scenario would be the patient who has an indeterminate mass. So we know there's a mass but doesn't meet the criteria for what we consider to be a malignancy. So we're not sure what it is. So when we do additional testing, most OBGYNs may choose to do CA125. If the CA125 is elevated in that indeterminate mass, according to ACOG, that patient will be referred to the GYN oncologist. So what I'm saying is that for the early stage disease, we have indeterminate mass, and she's one of the 50% of women with early stage disease that have normal CA125s, she would not be identified. She would then be operated on, perhaps by a benign gynecologist like myself. If that patient that has an indeterminate mass on ultrasound has a normal CA125, we fail to detect.
But would that mass indeed be identified as indeterminate had she been early, or would have mistakenly been identified as nothing?
And that's a good point. That deals with the subjectivity of ultrasound, because remember, it starts off with a ultrasound. We do the ultrasound, we identify the mass. At that point, we need to decide, is that a benign mass or a malignant mass? What do we have to do that? Well, over 1 helps us to decide that. If the ultrasound criteria is such that it's obviously a cancer, we can send that patient right to the GYN oncologist without any additional evaluation. What over 1 does is helps me clarify those patients that have indeterminate masses on my transvaginal ultrasound.
So you're basically saying if you cannot say it's definitely cancer, it's indeterminate.
Right. If it doesn't meet certain criteria on ultrasound features, then over 1 would be that test to help me decide if it's benign or malignant. If the over 1 score has a high probability of malignancy, that patient who had an indeterminate mass on ultrasound would then be referred to the GYN oncologist. Because right now, if you look at ACOG's statements, ACOG guidelines, it specifically talks about an elevated CA125. The problem is that 50% of women with early stage ovarian cancers have a normal CA125. Over 1 finds those women where CA125 misses. So that's the whole idea about over 1 being more sensitive. It's finding more disease. And with the negative predictive value, telling a woman that she has a negative or low probability score on over one, I can take that to the bank. I can tell you with almost 99% certainty that you do not have an ovarian cancer. But with a C125 only being 50%, I'm right and I'm wrong equally. I could flip a coin rather than even ordering a blood test.
And
so,
negative predictive value for CA125 in those situations is
60%. Right. So the reassurance that I have that the mass is negative is in the high 99 percentile. So improved sensitivity of detection. And again, we're talking about those indeterminate masses. If you do an ultrasound and it clearly has features suggesting ovarian cancer, that patient should be referred to the GY oncologist. I'm not looking for a reason to keep her in my practice. I would refer her out. But if I have a patient who has an early, if I have a patient who has an ultrasound where it's indeterminate, and I now add over one, and I have a high probability score, that patient's now going to get referred to the GY oncologist. And we see that based on the sensitivity that you're going to find more patients with ovarian cancer in early stage cancers with over one compared to CA125.
The care pathway chart might visualize that for you. Who's towards the end?
Okay, you can go.
Operator, in the meantime, could you be finding Dr. Shulman?
Yes, he is.
Dr. Shulman wants to call in, but he can't get into the toll-free number. Is there a direct line, or I can put him on my cell phone because he's out of the country?
You can put them on my cell phone if you want.
On your cell phone?
Might be able to visualize.
Let me text him your cell phone.
Can I explain again on the clinical pathway, if we can get to that slide?
I'll just text him.
Try to clarify.
Is it forward or backward?
I think it is
forward. Okay, could be
590.
317.
One more.
590.
One more.
8692.
692.
I think so it'll ring when it calls.
So, as I said, if you have a simple cyst on an ultrasound, you won't do anything about that. You wouldn't even order a blood test. You might repeat the ultrasound to make sure that it doesn't grow, but that is sort of the clearly benign reason. Then if you see patients with, you know, projections into the ovary, complex masses, ascites, or disease outside of the ovary, that's going to be considered clearly malignant. But most of these ultrasounds come in as not clear or indeterminate. They say, well, we think that this could be something, but we're not sure. And so that's that can be a low-risk one, but it can be harboring a cancer. So CA125 does not give you the negative predictive value you'd want as a benign gynecologist, Dr. Randell said. It's you would want to have a very high negative predictive value, and it reassure you that you can take care of that patient. And if the score is abnormal and you have a normal CA125, you would say, let's send this patient to the GYN oncologist.
Okay, let me ask you that.
It clears up the diagnostic dilemma for the gynecologist who's seeing these patients. And as I say, that relying on CA125 is unreliable, just based on the intrinsic low sensitivity of CA125, especially in the premenopausal.
Hello? Hello? Steve?
Yeah.
I can hear you. I can't hear anything else.
I know. Well, at least you're here. Yeah.
Yes, this is the conference operator. The speaker's line dropped.
Oh, can that be undropped?
If she redials back in.
Rats, okay.
Or if someone can chatter, she may not know.
Okay, let me see if I can.
I sent a text to Ola.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Are we back?
You're now connected.
I'm here, Carolyn.
Okay, good. We apologize for the disconnection. We don't know how it happened, but it did. We're glad you're back. Does anybody on the phone have questions or comments for the last three presenters?
Linda, she's going to ask.
Did they hear Dr. Shulman?
Did you hear Dr. Shulman?
No, we didn't.
Your line dropped off right at 4 o'clock Eastern time, so anything before that, no one heard.
Anything after that, yeah.
After that, sorry about that.
Who was speaking at 4 o'clock?
Well, he was the one speaking.
Time.
Yeah, just 5 minutes ago. So he was the one speaking. The last speaker was the one speaking. So you didn't hear him at all?
No, I think you were in the process, Carolyn, of getting somebody else on your phone or something. We didn't hear that person.
So the last person who spoke particularly about CA-125 and is out of the country?
I don't think so, no.
Do you want to get back on the phone?
I think what we'll do is, looking at the audience here, and I don't know who all is on the phone, we'll arrange a time that he can be on the phone with the staff at NGS.
Okay.
And he can call in to us and talk to us.
Any other questions or comments on the phone or here? Well, I want to thank everybody for your patience and your endurance. We appreciate the interest in the policies and we got a lot of good information, so thank you very much. Anything that anybody on the phone has to add? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.